We're up to page 185 in the Kuzari, paragraph 25 on the bottom. And we've officially concluded our discussion of Eretz Yisrael and its special quality for God and why a Jew can only achieve his maximal potential in the land of Israel. We're going on to the next topic. And the next topic begins with the following question. The Kuzari said, enough on this issue. I now would like you to bring me closer to an understanding of the things I have read in the Torah about the sacrifices, about the korbanos. It is difficult for the intellect to grasp such terms and ideas as my sacrifice, my bread, for my fire, my pleasant fragrance. We just read this morning's Torah reading for Rosh Chodesh. Es korbani lachmi li'ishai, reach nichochi. My sacrifice, that makes sense. Es korbani lachmi, my bread. Li'ishai, from my fire. Reach nichochi. My savory fragrance, or my pleasant fragrance. And that sacrifices are known as the offering of God, his bread and his fragrance. How do we make sense of this? Now, I'm going to ask you two questions now. First of all, first question is, what is he really asking? What is he bothered with? That's question number one. And question number two, which is a little bit more difficult to answer, is we know, we've seen a number of different topics in the Kuzari, and we know that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi sometimes jumps around from one topic to the other. But we would expect that a great scholar like Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi would not willy-nilly, you know, jump around from one thing to another unless there was some level of continuity, some connective tissue between one discussion and another topic. So what is the reason why he asks this particular question at this particular juncture of the work Kuzari? What does it have to do with the previous discussions that he's had up until now? Okay, so those are my two questions. Yes?
Maybe because you can only give korbanos in Eretz Yisrael?
Well, that's true, although originally it wasn't that way. I mean, you're right. It's not, but the limitation of giving korbanos in Eretz Yisrael is not per se Eretz Yisrael. It's that you need a temple.
Right.
But when we only had a Mishkan, we offered korbanos outside of Eretz Yisrael. There were people who offered it, like Noach, who was the first person that recorded Cain and Hevel were the first. And they too, they may or may not have been in Eretz Yisrael, but certainly Noach, Mount Ararat is in the Himalayas, it's not in Eretz Yisrael. So... yes. Just let me know if you're answering the first question or the second question.
Can you repeat the two so okay.
All right. Question number one is, what is bothering the Khazar king at this point? Why is he asking this question in the first place? Just if someone could speak that out. And question number two is, what does this question have to do with the previous discussion of Eretz Yisrael?
Okay. It's a bit of in left field, that it has to do with the idea of fragrance, which we read about this morning and which was spoken about by Rabbi Steiner yesterday at the
Sefer Torah. Remind us, please, what did he say?
He said that the fragrance fills them. One word of Torah, the fragrance fills the whole world with beautiful smell.
With beautiful fragrance.
Why is fragrance so important? And I'm saying it's a bit off left field, but the sense of smell is the one that is the most powerful emotionally. It brings back smell and taste. If you smell or taste something that you had as a child that was very good for you, It brings back
so many memories.
Much stronger than sight or hearing.
It's very good.
The most noble with Madeleine. He tastes the Madeleine, the biscuit, and it brings his whole life back to him.
Which work is this?
Remembrance of Things Past by Proust. And so the fragrance is a very powerful way of bringing back the whole experience of being close to God.
Oh, that's a, you know, that's a beautiful thought, especially for a person who brings a carbon. He's doing that in order to reconnect and to restore the damaged relationship. So perhaps that's the idea of the fragrance. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, that I think addresses the question, really you're trying to answer the question of, really my first question is, why does this bother the Khazar king? What is really bothering the Khazar king? What's bothering the Khazar king is that you can only anthropomorphize God up to a certain point. You can say that God gets upset, God is happy, God is sad. Do you remember the opening of the second Ma'amar, before we talked about Eretz Yisrael? Really, this conversation goes really back to the very beginning of the second Ma'amar, the second essay. When, you know, we talked about the different names of God. We talked about God being able to be merciful and gracious, while at other times he's called jealous and vengeful, but that God does not intrinsically change from one attribute to the other. That's on page 144. And one of the issues that is very central in a lot of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's writings, as well as many of the writings of the Rambam and other Jewish thinkers who try to be able to reconcile anthropomorphic terms of God that are contained in the Torah and God's truly transcendent nature, which we talked a little bit about last week, is that if God is completely removed from this world and is not human in any way, why then does the Torah attribute certain human traits and qualities to the Ribono Shel Olam? So that's really the one of the central themes. And we know that Dibra Torah Kelashon B'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in the language of human beings. God needs to find a method of communication that will resonate with us, and therefore he humanizes himself in order to be able to create that sense of relationship so that we can relate to Hashem and that we can understand what motivates God and what, in effect, stimulates God to act. You know, we do this with our kids all the time. In the way that we, you know, will sometimes sit down on the floor and play with them instead of expecting them to come to our level. We have to go down to their level and play with their toys instead of expecting them to come and have intellectual discussion about the meaning of life. And that's how we relate to our children. And Hashem has to come down to our level all the time. But you can only stretch that anthropomorphic description of God to a certain point. How do you get your head around the idea of Hashem imbibing the sacrifices? You see, you know, you can't smell without a nose, without, is that olfactory? Is that what we call it, the olfactory senses? Since when does God have any of those senses? And how can you call it his bread? So what do these terms really mean? It's one thing to say that God reacts to us in a way that shows how our action is either good or bad, but how does the Torah describe God imbibing of the karbanos, smelling the fragrance of the karbanos and consuming the karbanos? So that's really what's bothering Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and really in the words of the Khazar king. The connection is really going back to the beginning of the second essay, where this was really the central idea that the Khazar king was having difficulty with, which is, after, especially after leaving a worldview that is idolatry, and you have to remove yourself as a convert from the paganistic practices of the shrines that you are coming from, that you're leaving, how do you then reconcile ideas within Judaism that seem to be repetitious of pagan practices, such as the offering of animal sacrifices? So that's part of the question. And the only thing that we haven't really explained yet is, why does Eretz Yisrael interrupt this discussion? If the second essay started with a discussion of the names of God and how God intrinsically never changes because he's a truly transcendent and completely otherworldly creator, and we use the names as a borrowed term to help us understand Hashem better, and then this leads into this question, why the interlude for dozens of pages regarding a discussion of Eretz Yisrael? Does anyone remember how we got off topic to discussion of the land of Israel? See, this is why I like, you know, I like the idea of continuity. For me, I try to be able to make sense of all of the things. You know, the way that we got off topic to begin with on this discussion of Eretz Yisrael, it goes back to page 154. If you go back to page 154, there was a discussion of divine glory and divine light, that Hashem manifests himself to the world at different places and in different ways, depending upon human behavior. And in the course of that discussion, in paragraph number 8, the rabbi had said, "And in like manner, the glory of God is a reflection of divine light, which provides benefit to his people and his land." So the Kuzari said, "Your statement regarding his people is clear to me." And as you know, that's the idea of the chosenness of the Jewish people. "But your statement about his land is difficult to accept." And it was that was the transition point where we launched into this discussion of the special quality of the land of Israel. Okay? So as we're talking about the way that God, who is completely removed from this world, is somehow, in some mysterious way, able to insert himself into our world. So he's not human, he doesn't have any physical characteristics whatsoever, and yet there's still a divine light that can in some way manifest itself in certain places over other places in the world. So then the question becomes, if God is able to shine his light onto one people more than any other nation, then we have to explain how God can spatially confine himself as well to only into Eretz Yisrael. So again, this all has to do with the struggle, the theological struggle of the Khazar king, which is, how do you fit a transcendent God into the genie bottle, right? Which is, how do you take a transcendent God who really has nothing to do with the physical universe and confine him to spatial characteristics, to human anthropomorphic descriptions, and so forth? That's really that's the continuity of the entire theme of this second essay that we've seen up until this point. Okay? Very good. Patricia, were you going to say something?
Because so many of the Psalms, we talk about the eyes. They have eyes, but they see not. They have mouths, but they have not, like a big dream not, or
yes.
Means, but they don't bend.
Yes, yes.
And in contrast, the very physical eyes of bones of wood and stone to Hashem. And it's very definite that Hashem doesn't have any of those attributes.
Correct. And that's a very good point. As we will see later on in the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Levi actually does reference that very verse that you just mentioned.
It's in more than one psalm also.
Yes, yes, it's in many psalms. And a lot of times, Rabbi Yehuda Levi is forced to submit that we use these kinds of anthropomorphic terms of God seeing and hearing, not because God actually sees and hears, or even to say that God is alive is really incorrect. Because what does alive mean? He's the living God. Kel Chai, right? He's the living God. So what does living God mean? Living is only in reference to what we call living, which means I'm breathing, my heart is beating, my lungs are filling with air, I'm animated, I can think. But really, that's not what God is. So when we say that God is living, we really mean that God is not dead, that God is existent, and that he is real. That's what we mean when God is alive. But it's not the same kind of alive that we think of. So a lot of these things are borrowed terms, and that's really the way we have to resign ourselves when we think about a lot of these concepts about what divinity is all about, what Hashem is in his essence. We will ultimately have to resign ourselves that, with very rare exception, all of the terms that we use are really borrowed terms. They're not really, we don't possess a vocabulary to describe God accurately, because our vocabulary is based on our frame of reference and experience. Since we've never experienced really what God is in his true essence, we don't even have words to describe him. Yes?
I'm just wondering about the term you used before, confined. you say God, how could God be confined to Eretz Yisrael, confined to whatever? He's not really confined. That word confined somehow doesn't ring true with me. Yes, maybe he's more concentrated, but not confined.
Okay, so it's a slight semantic difference between the two. I agree with you. Okay, so before we go into how Rabbi Yehuda Levi is going to answer the question, I thought it might be useful for us to take a look at some traditional sources outside of Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Kuzari to see how this question has been undertaken by some thinkers. And I thought that the proper place to look is the first time where we find that God smells a carbon and is pleased. And when is that first time? When Noach gets off the Teva, Noach comes off the ark, and it says, Vayarach Hashem, and he offers sacrifices. He takes one of the animals, and he offers sacrifices to Hashem. So it says, Vayarach Hashem Esreach HaNichach. This is in Perek Ches Pasuk Chaf Aleph of Sefer Bereishis, that Hashem imbibes the savory fragrance. Vayomer Hashem Elibo. God says to himself, Lo osif lekalel odes ha'adamah ba'avur ha'adam. No, never again will I curse the land because of man. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra mi'urav. For after all, his inclination is evil from his youth. Velo osif od la'hakos kol chai kasher asisi. Never again will I smite other living creatures as I have done because of man. The Gemara says something very interesting. Amar Rebbe Chanina, Gemara in Maseches Erevin, Kol hamit pate biyeno, yesh bo midaat kono. That any person who is seduced by his wine is very imitative of God. Shenemar vayarach Hashem esreach anichoach begomer. As it says that God smelled the savory fragrance and he was appeased. So if you have a glass of wine and you are so mellow after that glass of wine, so you're just like Hashem. Don't feel bad that you had an altered state and that you've changed and you're now mellow because of that glass of wine. God does that too. God needs an occasional drink after all. You know, at the end of a hard day, even the Eibishter needs a glass of wine, right? Because things can change. People can become tense and upset. And because of difficult people in our lives, you ever have that situation where someone's like just grating on your nerves and you say at the end of a long day, I wish I had a stiff drink, right? So to calm me down and to be appeased, well, Hashem is that way as well. That's really what the Gemara is saying. And if anything, this Gemara seems to anthropomorphize Hashem even more than the Pasuk does. Is that it says that Hashem needed to calm down and to really be, you know, after all of this destruction and, you know, taking his beautiful world and just throwing it back into tohu vavohu and to making a big mess out of it all over again. And sometimes we feel like that. We just feel like taking the table and turning it over and just having a tantrum. And then take a glass of wine, relax. That's Vayarach Hashem Esreach Anichoach. It's God imbibing. It sounds quite irreverent when you put it in that way, doesn't it? And it almost sounds heretical that we can even attribute to God this kind of attitude. But this is exactly what the Gemara is saying. Yes?
I don't get it, because the reason Hashem said that is not because he changed the way he felt, because he felt better, but maybe he saw that if Noah could do this, then there's hope for mankind.
Yes.
It's an intellectual turnabout. It's not a physical or emotional turnabout.
What do you mean? What's the difference between intellectual and emotional in this context?
Is
there something that God was intellectually lacking before the flood?
Well, the knowledge that people could be better.
God didn't have that knowledge before?
Well, he saw it in front of him. When you're mellow because you have a glass of wine, it's just a physical difference. It's not you now know something that you didn't know then. To me, it seems totally different.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. Sometimes a glass of wine helps calm you down so that you can see the thing that was in front of you the whole time.
I don't know, I don't drink, so.
Maybe you should.
So does deep breathing or meditation. So listen,
I'm not advocating the use of mind-altering drugs. I am, I'm not one of these people, I know I come from California, so. Chazal themselves were cognizant of the fact that there are certain things that are outside of ourselves that sometimes we can use to relax ourselves, whether it's deep breathing or whether it's a glass of wine. No, there's nothing wrong with a glass of wine at the end of a long day. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it as long as it's taken in moderation, just like anything in life, right?
Rob.
Yes?
Also, that's confused me a lot, because I'm going to tell you why. As you were saying, Hashem doesn't have hands or smelling or eyes like we see in the song, right?
Yes.
So why Hashem needs to smell a korbanot? Is it really Hashem who needs to smell the korbanot, or is us to need to have the korbanot to...
Well,
connect to Hashem.
This is really the bottom line question. We certainly appreciate what you're saying, that the primary function of the korban, as the Ramban says, is for the bringer of the korban, that he or she should recognize, should have this mental attenuation to the fact that it really should be me that's burning on this altar, yes? But that's not exactly what the Pasuk tells us is happening when we bring a korban. That may be a benefit of the korban. But what the Pasuk tells us is happening in the story of Noach is that Hashem himself is transformed in some way. Hashem himself imbibes from the smoke of the, from the fragrance of the korban, and Hashem changes in some way. So that's the thing that's bothering Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. And that's what we really have to try and get down to. Now, our sages are only accentuating that even more. And they're telling us that just like a person can change as a result of a glass of wine, Hashem changes when he imbibes the fragrance of the korbanot. And that's the difficulty. It's not because we don't agree with what you're saying. You're suggesting that the person needs the korban. That's for sure true. But we have to reconcile it with the pasuk and especially with the words of the Gemara as well. So there are many different approaches to this. We'll just go through a few of them. And I don't think we're going to have a chance to go to the text of the Kuzari today. We'll save that for next time. The Ibn Ezra, on this pasuk, says in source number 3, he says, V'chalila chalila lihiyot Hashem meiriach. He said, God forbid that we should ever ascribe the human trait of smelling to the Almighty. V'lo ochel, nor does God eat. So therefore, when it says, as korbani lachmi, God's not smelling, God's not eating. Ki chein kasuv asher chelev zivachemo yochelu. After all, it says in Parshas Ha'azinu, when it talks about idolatry, it talks about false gods, it says they, false gods eat. God doesn't eat. Rak hatam shekibel ha'ola. But what it means is that God accepts the sacrifice, the yashra lefanav, and it was fitting in his eyes, it was pleasing in his eyes. Ka'adam shemeiriach reach tov hu arev. Just like a person smells something, geshmak, right? When you smell something really good, that's God's attitude changes. God is able to see that which he always intellectually knew, that human beings are capable of change, as you had mentioned. And because Hashem sees that human beings can take the initiative and change their destiny, and that there is always hope, man is not beyond redemption, it's for that reason that Hashem is able to accept the korban. So that's really the point that the Ibn Ezra is making, that it is a metaphor. Just like when you smell something, you're not really getting anything from it, but it changes your emotional state. So too, when Hashem smells a carbon and he sees the future of humanity has a light, is bright, there's a hope for humanity, then that's why Hashem is able to change as a result of the carbon. So you see very clearly from the Ibn Ezra that God is not imbibing anything that is that he needs or that he can derive benefit from. It's a figurative sense. It's a figurative metaphor, is the way the Ibn Ezra understands it. The Radak says something similar, and he says, "Vayarach Hashem dibrat Torah kelashon b'nei Adam b'derach mashalhu." He says it quite outright. He says the Torah speaks in anthropomorphic terms, and this is purely a metaphor. It's purely an analogy. Kamo sha'amar ha'ochel b'sar abirim, like it says in Tehillim, that God eats the flesh of mighty animals. And all of the pasuk means to imply is that God accepts willingly man's offering and it is pleasant to him. And what the pasuk is trying to convey in this particular instance when it says that God accepts the sacrifice, and even when a fire comes down from heaven, so to speak, to accept the sacrifice, that God is wants to inform man, ki ratza b'briyat ha-notarim min ha-babul v'samach bahem, that God actually is happy with the survivors of the flood. And he rejoices in them, and he sees that they have value in redemption. Kemo she'nemar yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, as it says, that God will rejoice in his creations. Hefech ma she'amar b'dor ha-mabul v'yit'atzev el-libo. And this is therefore the pairing. What the Radak is doing is he is pairing the end of the story to the beginning of the story of the flood. The beginning of the story of the flood, which is at the end of Parshas Bereishis, it says that God is truly sad in his heart. He's sad in his heart when he sees mankind self-destructing, when he sees people killing each other and constantly at war and not able to get along and exploiting and taking from other people and not sharing and not being kind and not being human. God is sad. So what happens at the end of the story when Noach comes off the Teva and God sees truly an altruistic act of humanity, that Noach is able to offer gifts up to Hashem? Ki ada ki lo yihye ba'olam od kemo oto hador. That God realizes that it is possible for mankind to redeem himself, and I know that never again will there be such a kind of depraved level of humanity as there was before the flood. And that's why this pasuk is necessary to show that there is a rehabilitation of mankind. That just like God is sad, so to speak, and again, I think the Radak would submit that that's also an anthropomorphic term, that's a borrowed term, God doesn't get sad, God doesn't get happy, right? It's the same thing over here, that God is able to demonstrate through his acceptance of a korban that he sees that man has purpose, there is inherent goodness within humankind, when mankind wishes it to be so, and there is a future for mankind, a bright future for mankind, which Hashem truly rejoices in, when mankind makes proper choices. Okay? Are we getting any closer to a definition of God imbibing the fragrance? Okay. Now, we're going to take a left turn with the Ricanati. The Ricanati is an Italian commentary. He lives one generation past the Ramban and is already steeped in the world of the Zohar and the Kabbalah. And you find, whereas the Ibn Ezra and the Radak were not involved with the Zohar, they were lived earlier than the Zohar, the Ricanati already is in the medieval period past, I think he's 14th century already, and therefore already you see the influence of the Zohar already changing the way that human beings relate to these anthropomorphic terms. The Ricanati says, "Vayorach Hashem et reach nichach begomer." He says, "Kishem sheyesh evarim ba'adam miyuchadim lefu'ulatam." Just like every human being has different organs, and each organ has a different function, ha'ayin lirot v'chayotze b'hem, the eye sees, and the ear hears, and the mouth tastes, and so forth. Kach yesh kochos elokios lemaila. So too, there are divine organs, or divine faculties, I should say. Nikraim ba'osan hashemos memunim al pu'ulasam. And these divine faculties have the same name as human organs. God has eyes, God has a nose, God has a mouth. but in a completely different plane of existence. It's not a physical mouth, it's not physical eyes, but God has the same faculties on a divine level as human beings have on a human level, on a physical level. And therefore, v'zeh sod gadol yitba'er b'parshat vayechi, and this will be explained later on, but it's a very deep secret. And then he has a lengthy quote from the Zohar, which we won't go into now. You can take a look at that on your own if you understand Zoharic Aramaic, which is very, very difficult. But, I can translate it for you. Basically, it talks about the two nostrils of God. The Zohar has this very cryptic quote, and in the right nostril goes in certain fragrances, and the left nostril goes certain fragrances. And it's even more cryptic than what the Rikanati has said in the first paragraph. But the point is that when we talk about man being created in God's image, sometimes all we need to do is look at the human being and discover Hashem. If we want to be able to understand more about God and we know that we were created in His image, then let us look internally at mankind, at the human being, and see what God is all about. That's really the whole approach of Kabbalah, is that the human being is a microcosm of God, and that God has multiple organs just like the human being does. And this is very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous kind of speculation, because it ascribes certain human attributes to the Almighty. There was very interesting, in the times of the Rambam, who lives about two centuries before the Rikanati, there is a text that the Rambam is familiar with called Shi'ur Koma. It's a midrash called Shi'ur Koma. And it describes a conversation between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael as describing the physical dimensions of the Almighty's body. Now, this is not a medrash that your sons or daughters will be learning in yeshiva or seminary. Okay? It is one of those esoteric midrashim that is not part of the popular midrash says kind of midrash. Okay? But it nevertheless exists. And it is part of the corpus of rabbinic literature, and therefore it has to be contended with. You can't just sort of like ignore it and say, well, you know, it's not part of what my kids learn in second grade, so it just that's not part of rabbinic literature. You know, there's a whole corpus of rabbinic literature that's just difficult to reconcile because of some of these very, very difficult statements, and they're not taught, so we can somehow pretend that they don't exist, but they do exist. Okay. You'll see that Rabbi Yehuda Levi, at some point, I don't remember where, will quote Shi'ur Koma. But the Rambam was asked about this Medrash Shi'ur Koma, and he was so opposed to these anthropomorphic rabbinic texts that he said that this text, a whole medrash called Shi'ur Koma, is a forgery. He says it was not written by the rabbis, and it is a Byzantine forgery. It was a text that was introduced by Christians, and it crept into rabbinic literature and was passed off as an authentic statement by the sages. Now, the Rambam did this because he was so opposed to any kind of anthropomorphic attributions to God, such as what the Zohar does. But you see that there are two very, very different traditions in Jewish thought that have been passed down to us even to this day. The Maimonidean approach is to completely elevate and create a transcendent God that is devoid of any human characteristics whatsoever. And you have a Zoharic tradition, which is equally valid and has been passed down to us, which not only accepts the Torah's anthropomorphisms as literal, but builds upon them and explains them and even builds an entire structure of what I guess you would call theologically a Godhead of 10 different manifestations. That's the Eitz Chaim, right? 10 different manifestations of God. During Sfiras HaOmer, Hod Shebi Gvura Malchus, right? All of these terms, these are different manifestations of the essential God. The Rambam would have looked at your Siddur that you use today, whatever, after every day, it's, you know, Gvura Sheba Hod and Malchus Sheba Hod and Malchus Sheba Gvura, and he would have said, this is Avodah Zarah. How can you attribute all of these different attributes to the divine, which has no attributes? And this is part of the struggle that we are seeing forming in the writings of Rebbe Yehuda Halevi. But you see, the Rikanati has no problem with it because he's already relying on very heavily on the Zohar, which is viewed already at a very, very early stage of its publication as an authentic rabbinic text, which must be accepted as legitimate and authentic. Whether the Rambam was aware of the Zohar is unclear to us. It's a whole other discussion. The Zohar was not made accessible to the public until over a century after the Rambam had passed away. So we have no indication that he had any access to any of the texts that Rabbi Moshe de Leon had transcribed into the Zohar. So I just want to bring this to your attention, is that you see different schools of thought struggling with these anthropomorphisms of the Torah. And then finally, we'll take a more contemporary approach, which is from the Malbim, and with this we'll conclude for today. The Malbim says, Vayarach Hashem Esreach Hanech. The Malbim, of course, is 19th century, even though he sometimes sounds like he's one of the Rishonim. He says, Inyana Korban, hu shesoreif es guf habal chai le'afar. The Malbim here explains what it means, what is the efficacy of a korban. He says, God incinerates the body of the animal into dust, into ash. V'hachalakim haruchaniyim olim l'mayla al yedei ha'esh ha'mafrid ben ha'divakim. And so what is left after you reduce the body into carbon? The only thing that's left of a creature, a living creature, are its spiritual components, which ascend in the fire that is burning the physical components. And that is sort of like what happens when you burn a physical animal. You're allowing all of the spiritual elements of that creature to escape in the process of burning and ascend back up to its to their source. Umizeh, and when a person has that experience of burning an animal on the altar, yilmad lahachnia kochos chomro ulevatlam ulosarfam. The human being, this is of course what Mr. Shlam was saying, learns how to derive a lesson from this to subjugate his physical aspects, to nullify them and to completely destroy them. Ayedei rishfei hash'ei shalheves ahavas Hashem. Through the passion, the fiery passion of his love for Hashem. Shema'ale ruchniut nafsho al yedei machashavto vekavanaso hatova la'Hashem. That he causes the spiritual components of his soul to rise above his physical nature, and everything can be brought up to Hashem. V'Hashem mitzareif machashavto hatova l'maaseh. And through this, God takes your thoughts that you are mustering through your offering of the korban and makes it as if you are doing something actual. V'zeh reach ha-korban. That's what the word reach means, the fragrance. Rot salomar ruchniut shebo. The word reach comes from the word ruchniut, ruchnius, which is the spiritual essence of any physical thing, is called its ruchnius. So that's why the word reach is used, fragrance. Fragrance has that quality that Patricia was mentioning before of being able to hearken us back to a time, maybe something even in the far-flung past of our lives, because it connects something. From the view of our religious thinkers, it connects actually to our soul. The sense of smell connects most to our spiritual essence, and that's why it connects so much to our memory faculties. And so that's what the Malbim is saying. And therefore, Vayorach Hashem, Shehashem Mekabel Haruchnius Ha'olam Meharkorban, that when it says that God imbibes the fragrance, it's really that God is imbibing the Ruchnius that is detached from the physical and comes up to him. V'hu nachas ruach lefanav, ki'ilu Noach atzmo hikrives atzmo lekorban. And that's what God is expressing. It's as if Noach himself had offered himself on the altar and completely extracted his spiritual essence and brought it up to God himself. V'al ze amar b'midrash, hareach reach shel Avraham ola mikivshan ha'esh, hareach reach shel Chananya, Mishael, va'azaria. And that's why the Medrash tells us that the fragrance of a korban is the fragrance of Avraham Avinu when he was thrown into the furnace. The fragrance of a korban is the fragrance of Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah who were thrown into a furnace to die al Kiddush Hashem. Rotzalomar, what that means is, ki roshem shel hashoresh nishar ba'anafim. He says, an imprint of the root remains in the branches. That it is through this commitment to be moser nefesh, to give up of your life, to sacrifice your life, that this is passed down to all future descendants, that every time a Jew brings a korban, he is hearkening back to that ability for a Jew to give up his life, al kiddush Hashem, to throw himself into a furnace. Kemo shehashoresh hu nach hu Noach masar nafsho b'machshava alos almo kedal l'shem Hashem. Just like Noach also was able through his thoughts to place himself on the altar, every time a Jew does something altruistic and selfless and sacrificial for God, he is, in a sense, hearkening back to that original act of Avraham, of Noach and Hanani, Mishael and Azariah. And when God sees that, God imbibes the fragrance and is able to reconcile himself with mankind. I mean, can you just imagine what people perceived as the stench coming from Auschwitz must have been the Reach Nichoach that God smells of Jews not figuratively being Moser Nefesh, but actively being Moser Nefesh. This is the image that just comes to me from reading this Malbim. Okay, we have more to discuss on this topic, but I'd like to put it aside for now and go to some words on the parsha.